Hey there, everyone. Welcome into another episode. My name is Dan Hafner. Welcome back to the show. Appreciate you joining again. I have another awesome guest for you guys today. We're going to talk with a man by the name of Brian Childress. I'll bring him on in a second. But before I get started with that, just wanted to mention to all of you who are listening to this show on audio, we do have a video version of this show now. Never used to do that before, but you can check it out on YouTube. You can either Google Dan Hafner or Dapper Mobile Apps, and you should find the channel. So this goes live every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. For interviews and shows like this. And if you are watching the video show, whether it's on E360 TV Network or on YouTube, always encourage you to either listen to the podcast on the go or anything like that. You can listen to this show anywhere you get your podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, Apple Podcasts, anything like that. So appreciate all of you for that. And if you enjoy this show, please, please, please do a rating. Do a review. That really, really helps the show grow and get more visibility and all that fun stuff. So with that out of the way, I'm going to bring on my new guest here today, Brian Childress. How are you doing, Brian? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Doing great, Dan. Thanks for having me, bud. So Brian Childress, I'm located in Virginia. I am doing all sorts of fun things these days, but I'm a software engineer and architect by trade and training. And I get to work with a number of different startups and small and medium businesses, helping them to develop really fun custom software these days.
Yeah. Because we were just talking before we started. Really excited to have you on the show. I'm probably going to talk a little bit about this in the personal segment of this show. But for those of you who really don't know more of kind of what I do, Brian and I kind of do the same thing, but we kind of do it in different ways. So that's why I thought it'd be really cool to have him on and talk about some things. I got to ask you, Brian, let's just go right out of the gate. Let's go something crazy. Like what's like the craziest type of software or maybe interesting project that you've ever worked on with a client?
That's a tough one. I'll give you... Earlier this year, I got contacted by a group that had been spent probably 5-6 months developing an AI-based software solution for a foreign government, and they were struggling. And so I kind of got brought into the project pretty late in the game and helped to turn it around. And I would say within, a couple hours, we had a new architecture defined. Within a couple days, we had it implemented. And within a week, we were up and running with brand new architecture. Data was flowing. Everything was kind of working end to end. And then we were able to refine and hone things. So I would say that was probably the fastest, like, I've never met you guys to completely, re-architecting everything in, about the course of a week. It was pretty wild.
Yeah, that sounds pretty interesting, but I noticed a theme there also kind of in line with the title of the show, Simple Software Always Wins. I really like that that theme or that little short sentence, right? So it sounds like you kind of kept things simple for them, right? Like, or at least you tried to simplify things and tell people why that's so important. Like, I think, especially, you and I both know you work with people. There's always this thing called scope creep that, everyone tends to have almost all the time. So why when you're developing software, when you're building something, why is it so important to keep it simple?
Technology and software is complex just by the nature of it, right? And so I think I see a lot of times is we make things even more complex than they already are. And so I always encourage teams and developers to just keep it simple, right? You're not going to need a lot of the fancy patterns and tools and technologies that are out there to solve the problem. And I mean, the project I mentioned earlier, most of what I did in that re-architecting effort was go in and rip out about 80% of things that we didn't need, and just made it much more simple so that everyone on the team was able to understand how data flowed, how we were storing things, how kind of all the pieces interacted with each other, which then enabled me to be able to hire more people and bring them on quickly. And they were able to get up to speed so much more quickly than the previous kind of software setup had allowed. So I prefer to keep things simple. I'm a simple guy. You know, I grew up in the country, you know, say what you will, but it's just so much easier to understand for everyone.
Yeah, no. And there's actually it's funny, maybe I'm behind the times, but I've been seeing a lot more, you know, inside of newsletters, different things that I'm subscribed to, kind of exactly what you're talking about, this term of technical debt, right? They talk about, they kind of tie it into, you know, you might have like financial debt, things like that, like mortgages, cards, you know, loans, whatever. And I never thought of it in this kind of way, but there is such a thing as technical debt. Like you said, there might be extra systems that you built that don't really go anywhere, or you tie something into like a Zapier thing where you're trying to do things, but then it's not using it any longer, or extra pages or extra functionality or buttons that don't go anywhere, those types of things. Yeah. Help us explain, hopefully you've heard of this, like this term of technical debt, like maybe explain that a little bit better for people. And like, how can you go through that process of eliminating technical debt when you come into a project or when you're starting a new project?
Technical debt's an interesting one. And I think every engineer I've met, every team I've been on or project I've been a part of has had a different definition of technical debt. And a lot of times, you know, I think us as engineers, we use that to describe the things that we don't like about the platform, right? We don't like the framework, so it's technical debt, or we don't like the way that it's deployed, and so it's technical debt. And that may not necessarily be the case. Typically, the way I think about technical debt is it's something that is hindering our ability to provide a great experience, whether it's a great developer experience or a great experience for our customers and, you know, the business. And I always like to focus on what is the business use case. And so I think, a lot of times the thing that I see leading to what we call technical debt is just a difference in understanding. It's just my definition of something versus your definition of something could be drastically different. Right. The one I always like to pick on is when a business stakeholder comes to me and says, I want this data updated in real time. Right. For you and I as engineers, real time means something very different than what, a business stakeholder might mean. Right. Real time for them might mean, yeah, when I get to the office in the morning, I want to have the most updated data. OK. But for you and I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, background jobs and just crazy things that have to happen in order for it to be actually real time or as close to real time as possible. And so I think a lot of times we're not on the same page, right? And so, you know, the same kind of thing when we talk about scale and, you know, this is going to be huge and I want it to be, you know, globally scalable, and we just have different definitions. And so I always try and ask like, thought-provoking questions of like, what do you mean by scale? Like, what does that look like for you? And for me, I found that helps to eliminate technical debt. Or if we have, you know, pieces and parts of the system that really are, creating debt, we can kind of eliminate them just by reframing our understanding of the problem we're trying to solve.
That's really well put. I really like that. That's a really, really interesting idea. Okay. So let's kind of shift gears a little bit. And I want to talk about this non-technical founders topic of, you know, I think a lot of us, like, especially in this field, we see a lot of people like you and I tend to be, I never started out this way. I kind of became technical as, you know, kind of learned things on my own. And I think a lot of people can kind of hold their own when it comes to, a lot of us use computers in our jobs and everything that we do anyway. So when we talk about a non-technical founder, kind of what we're talking about and defining that as is really someone who doesn't know how to build software, whether it's through a custom coding solution or a no coding solution, those types of things. They just kind of have this idea that's like, hey, I want to make this app that does this, or I want to make this software that solves this problem. Mm-hmm. Right. So in that phase, like we just talked about with a gentleman last week on the show about kind of how he went through this hole with his app. So like what do you see as someone who works with people like this a lot? What's like the biggest hurdle or biggest issue, problem, whatever you want to call it, that like a non-technical founder will face when it comes to this, you know, going on this down this path or on this venture?
Yeah, I think it's a could be a big struggle for folks that don't have that technical background and understand how software is built or how some of these systems come together. It almost feels magical to some extent, right? It's just this, you know, black box of something happens and I know it's very expensive to build and I just don't know. And so I think a lot of times just non-technical founders don't know what they don't know. And so they look for someone who seems to be technical, who might have some technical capabilities, and then they just latch onto them because they are the ones that can kind of harness this thing that is very hard to understand. And it can be difficult for non-technical founders. And that's why I really love to work with them to help and understand, do you need an app? What does an app look like? What does it actually take? And kind of give a bit of background just so that they kind of have a bit more understanding and then can go into some of the decisions and the conversations with a little bit more of an education there.
That's interesting. I always think about, you know, those domains of we know what we know what we don't know, or we don't know what we don't know, like the unknown unknowns. You know, that's really interesting. I never heard that one. So I had it. I lost it. What was it? Oh gosh. Come on, Dan. Think, Dan. Oh gosh, it'll come back to me. That's interesting though, because if you don't, came back to me. Okay. So yeah, sometimes people will say, hey, I want this app that does this thing. And you know, I've had conversation with people that's like, okay, I see what you're trying to do. And you want this awesome, cool cross-platform thing that's downloadable on Android and Apple and has responsive things and all this type of stuff. And then people don't really realize that that actually costs a lot and it takes a lot of work to do. Whereas, you know, that kind of goes into my next thing of validating ideas of like, is there a process that you take people through on like how to properly validate an idea, how to go through like, hey, this is what really people want and people will pay for and people will use. Is there a certain process that you take people through for that?
Yeah, my typical flow is, you know, if someone comes to me and says, Dan, I got a great idea for an app and I want you to build it for me, you know, I first try and level set. It's like, okay, fantastic. Most custom software projects that you're talking about, you know, let's say it starts at $100,000 is going to be your upfront cost. And then once, you know, I pick them up off the floor because they fainted because it was, you know, okay, let's talk about your idea. What is it that we're trying to solve for, right? Not what are we trying to build? We always tend to, you know, especially as technologists, we always go to the solution first and not necessarily the problem. And so I try and help them to understand what is the problem that we're trying to solve? Who is our, you know, our ideal client? What are they buying? Like, who is going to be paying for this thing to offset this huge development cost? And in that, we start to figure out what is, you know, what is the problem in a potential set of solutions. The next phase for me is really try and encourage that founder to go out and talk to people, to talk to that ideal customer, right? If they are able to go out and identify the person that is like throwing money at them for something that hasn't even been built, that's still an idea, then they're so much closer to being able to tap into that potential market. From there, the next phase for me, I like to encourage founders, technical or non-technical founders, to then like maybe hire a designer to put together like a clickable prototype, right? Figma is fantastic for this. There's other programs, but put together something that is visual, because that really creates, you know, really gives us something that we can kind of talk to and point to and, oh, now I understand. Now we can kind of get onto the same page. And then once we're able to basically sell a clickable prototype, then we can start to look at, okay, what is the next iteration of that? And I've taken a lot of founders from, I need this custom app. And I mean, you know what mobile apps and custom software can cost. It's like, what can we do with like a Google form and a set of Google spreadsheets? Let's solve the problem. Just incrementally adding technology on top. So typically it's like bare minimum. What can we do with free or very low cost tools? I like to then go to like a no code or a low code type solution. And then at that point, we can start to look at custom software, but it's almost always at the end. And kind of back to your question earlier around like non-technical founders and some of the challenges that they have. I think a lot of people will say, if the first thing that we think is, oh, I want an app built, I'm going to go find somebody that builds apps. And we all kind of pick on like development agencies and freelancers, like, yeah, they're going to latch onto that. Like, I'll build an app. It doesn't matter if it's what you actually needed to begin right. with. Yeah, I'll take your money. I'll take, you just cashed out your 401k for this fantastic idea. I'm going to build it. It's going to be more expensive and take longer than you ever would have thought. And then you get it to the market and nothing. No one wants it because you weren't actually solving a problem. But, so I always like to be the technical resource that helps to like, let's identify and validate that idea. And so that's typically the flow that I'll go through.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's, I will admit, even when I started, I think, when I started in business, I think it was, there is that, you need customers, mm-hmm. And you always need, you need to get projects under your belt when you're building things. So it's very easy to say like, hey, I have this app idea that I just want built, and I know it's going to be great, and it's going to be awesome. Here's $10,000, get me something going. Okay, yep. Great. Like, no questions asked. You know what I mean? But I do. I think that's why a lot of things eventually fail. And there's, I've heard there was one client that came to me that said she had a friend that had put 50K into a app idea and like literally had nothing to show, like literally no, not even like a prototype, not even any kind of thing that was like usable. I'm like, okay, how does that happen? First of all, like that's a nightmare. That's ridiculous. You know what I mean? So I do like, do you see a lot of, I'm just curious, do you see a lot of, I don't want to call it fraud, but do you see a lot of like deception in the freelancer market or the agency market when it comes to this stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's super unfortunate. I was talking with a group, maybe it was a month or two ago now, who had spent $100,000, nothing to show for it. They were just completely lost. Like, I don't know if this group ever built anything that was of value. I don't know, I have no access to the code. I don't own the website for this thing that I'm trying to build my business on top of. It's really unfortunate. So I try and spend a lot of time educating around that. And unfortunately, a lot of the folks that I work with, it's trying to pick up the pieces after that.
So let's think about this. I wasn't even planning on asking you this, but how do we combat that? You and me as people in this industry who are trying to build things with integrity, with inside of our reputation of like, hey, we can do this for you. How do we combat that? Like, is that a cultural thing? Is that a best practices thing? Like, how do we combat that kind of stuff? Can you even do that?
That's tough, right? I think. Wow. For me, I try and find where are those non-technical founders, where are they kind of hanging out and how are they coming up with the idea and then going and sourcing some of these, agencies or something like that. Unfortunately, there are a lot of agencies and it's very easy for me to go on and find somebody, they'll start taking my money. And because I don't know that I need to make sure that I own all of the code and I own all of the, intellectual property and all of the assets and all of those sorts of things, folks can get into a really bad position. So, I mean, for me, I try and educate and be in front of as many of those folks as possible. And hopefully that can continue to spread. So for me personally, I try and get ingrained in a lot of the startups and incubators, accelerator type programs, and just try and be a resource for those non-technical founders. And if they're going out and considering hiring a development agency or a freelancer, like, hey, here are some of the steps you should probably consider.
Okay. Awesome. Well, we're going to go to a commercial here real quick, kind of at the 20-minute mark. So we'll be right back. But before I do that, I'm also going to have a shameless plug for myself while we're in here. If that's something you want some more information on, I just got done putting together an academy. You can find it at academy.dappermobileapps.com. It's all educational. It's like a couple hundred bucks. You can get educated. It's a lot around the topic of no code. It could be a really, really good starting and launch pad point for you if you're looking for that. So thank you for segueing me into that, Brian. Really appreciate that. We'll talk more about your stuff here later on, but we're going to go to a quick commercial and we'll be right back.
Introducing Launchpad, the perfect partner to help you launch your dream project to the world. We know that time is of the essence, and we are here to help you make the most of it. With Launchpad, you'll get access to the most advanced digital tools and strategies to take your idea from a mere concept to a fully fledged success. Whether you're an aspiring entrepreneur or a seasoned pro, we have everything you need to make your mark in the world. So why wait? It's time to take the leap and make your vision a reality. Launchpad, your ultimate launch partner. Let's make magic together.
My name is Adriana Morrison, host of the Health Revolution TV show. Join us Tuesdays and Thursdays live, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where our mission is simple: engaging conversations, elevating health and wellness, empowering transformation. Right here on the Achieve TV channel, on
E360. All right, everyone, welcome back to the show. I am joined again by Brian Childress. We're talking some dev stuff. We're talking some software stuff, simple software. Forget the exact name of the title now. So let's talk some interesting stuff here, Brian. I want to talk about learning from mistakes. You know, we've all made mistakes in any kind of career that we're in. Software development, we just got talking about some of the financial mistakes that people can make. Let's talk about some of the, project mistakes that you've made. Is there anything that you can really put out there for advice for maybe a non-technical founder or anybody that's, working with something or launching something outside of like, hey, I put 50 grand into this and didn't get anything back. What are some of the big mistakes that you've made that you can learn from?
I don't think we have enough time for that one, Dan. I think that's, I consider it an advantage for me having been in the industry for so long and having, stepped on that many rakes and they smacked me in the face. You know, there's a lot of mistakes I've made around, how did I handle certain projects? How did I choose certain technologies? How did I allow scope creep into projects and that impacted timeline and budget and those sorts of things? But I think for folks that are either currently developing or considering developing projects, I think managing control over some of the resources and the assets that we have. One of the big mistakes I see a lot of folks make, whether they're technical or not, is kind of handing over full access to their code repositories, to their cloud hosting environments, to their domain registration. And all of that, if you hired a freelancer or you hired a development agency, maybe they are the ones that set those things up for you. And that's one of the biggest mistakes that I see, is because now that group, that person is in full control of what you're trying to build your multi-billion dollar business on. And I've seen that just go so wrong so many times. And so I always encourage folks to just maintain control and then hand out the pieces of access that individuals need and be able to kind of pull that access back at any point. So whether it's code or hosting or anything along those lines.
That's interesting. I've actually had some people come to me, especially since I work more in, and let's talk about this now, like the no code versus the code thing. That is always one thing that has, well, I shouldn't say always, sometimes it's been something that has turned people off from working with me when it says, hey, we're going to build this inside of Bubble or Adalo or one of those no-code platforms, is the actual fact that you can't own that code. Like, you can't really say like, hey, I have this platform and I can't own it. Now there are, I will say, there are some new platforms that are coming out where you can do that, where you can build things inside of a no-code platform and then get that code exported to you so you can own that code. But I also see, like you said, like sometimes people are just looking for an MVP or just a validated product to put out there as something that's more than a prototype, more than like something like Figma, but it's actually clickable and it works and it might not be the final project. But you know, what are some of the differentiators when someone comes to you that you might say, okay, let's go with a no code thing first, or we should actually do custom? Is it more of the validated idea? Is it the traction? Is it the features that are needed? Because sometimes in no code, you can't build all the features you really need. So what's like a threshold for you? It's hard to, every project is different, but what's like, you know, what are some of the things that make you differentiate between that?
Gotcha. So, I mean, I'd have to give the classic answer of it depends. But for me, I prefer to kind of go towards no code or low code solutions. If we're still trying to figure out what is it that we're building, what does it look like? What's the interaction model? So you know, we're past that clickable prototype. We want to be building something. So many applications I see can fit within that paradigm where they can stay with a low code or a no code solution. And that's what they need. You know, when I'm selecting one of those platforms, what I look for are things that I call escape hatches, right? There's certain functionality, right? There's a limit, right? Because no code and low code, they're a framework, right? And all frameworks have some sort of limitation. And so how can I get out of that limitation? Maybe I need to integrate with a payment processing platform, and the particular, you know, platform that I've chosen may not integrate directly, or, you know, I need to get data from a REST API that exists somewhere else. Can I do that? And if I can, then that's something that I definitely want to consider, because basically the way I like to handle those types of projects is, okay, we start with low code or no code, one of those solutions. We get to, you know, where we can start to see the bounds of what that platform can provide for us. And then with what I call an escape hatch, I have a way to get out and continue to add functionality. And basically we're moving from one of those platforms into custom software. Now, if we're clear about what we're building, it's something that can fit within, you know, a very common tech stack. Again, simple software. I love boring technologies. So, you know, I'll play around with leading edge and bleeding edge technologies, but I'm not going to bring them into my clients' projects unless it's the only solution. And so if it's a fairly, you know, clear cut type of thing that we're building and it makes sense for us to build it with these boring technologies, then maybe we can pursue custom development. But, you know, maybe the founder wants to have some control of being able to add functionality without having to go to a development team and waiting for that, you know, full development process to happen. So I think there are a lot of things to consider, but I tend to encourage folks to start with one of those platforms. But when selecting them, just make sure that we have kind of an exit strategy, if you will.
That makes perfect sense. That's a very, very good answer. Very good answer. Okay, another quick question before we move on to another topic about no code. I've got a lot of reports. I see a lot of different things. I think there's actually one of the main platforms I work in, Adalo, which I've really come to love and really, really use a lot recently. I saw they have a whole thing on their site that kind of goes through like a possible future timeline of things. And long story short, there a lot of people are saying that within the next 5 to 10 years, I mean, it's always going to be kind of, you know, skewed one way or another. Saying basically in the next 5 to 10 years, 60 to 70% of all development projects are going to be inside of some no code platform. Do you agree with that? And if so, why or why not?
I can see potential, you know, those exact percentages, maybe not. But I do think that we're going to see more of a migration from custom software to some of those platforms, right? And I'm thinking back in my experience, I mean, heck, 10 years ago, you know, I was working in the financial sector and, you know, we had an internal development team, we had an offshore development team, like we had a big group that was developing custom software and it still wasn't fast enough, right? It was still taking a long time to do. And so there were something like, say, 100 different applications that were essentially very, very fancy Excel spreadsheets and Access databases that most of the business ran on those things that individuals in the organization that were not quote unquote software engineers were building to enable them to do their job, because the IT team and the custom development team was just, they didn't have the capacity or the speed to deliver for the business. And so I'm saying that because I think we've continued to see it. I think we're going to continue to see it where businesses are moving so much more quickly. There's so many platforms that we can easily integrate in and add on to, you know, existing functionality that I think a lot of these other platforms, we can make it easy to integrate a lot of different things, you know, the chat GPTs and a lot of those types of tools, if we could pull all those together pretty easily. Yeah. I think custom software, there's still going to be a place for it. Absolutely. But I think by and large, I would expect to see more of a shift for your day-to-day business type applications to kind of move towards some of those platforms.
That's interesting. I mean, when I see things like that, I'm like, I don't know. Even as someone who's a huge advocate for the no-code and low-code space, my gut tells me I feel like it might be there eventually. I don't know if it's going to be the next 5-10 years, to be honest with you. But I think it would go there, because it's funny when you talk about what you just said, like there's a place for the custom software development. I feel like, you know, forever it's been custom building things, and they're like, well, there's kind of a place for no code for like these simple things that you need or like different things like that. And what you're talking about is actually the inverse of that. It's actually flipping that to be like the default would be, hey, let's go build this thing in this other tool that we can build and stand up in a day. And then if we need some custom things, we'll go build those over here and put more money and resources into it. So that's super, super interesting. But anyway, you also mentioned another thing right here about AI. You mentioned ChatGPT. So again, another great segue. So I'm interested for your thoughts. I've been talking the last couple episodes. I've talked a lot about AI. For any of you who've been paying attention to the past couple of episodes, if not, go back and listen to them. I've had quite a few interesting topics around this. So I'm interested for your thoughts on. It's a very generic question, but what are your thoughts on how AI is working? How it's changing the world of software development? How it's, you know, where it's possibly going? It's again a very generic question, but I'm just interested for what you think about it all.
Yeah, you know, I'm not afraid that AI is going to take my job any day. You know, I don't think the robots are going to be taking over there. But it certainly has and will continue to change the way that I work every day, right? I mean, yesterday I was putting, you know, functions that I wrote into ChatGPT and asking it to generate, you know, a set of unit and integration tests for me. And that, like, the ability to do that has really supercharged my workflow. I'm able to produce the things that I need to produce so much more quickly and more accurately. Now, I think it, you know, from a software engineering perspective, it's important to kind of understand what is ChatGPT or any of these other tools? What are they actually providing me? Is it any good? You know, there were scenarios where what it generated was pretty good, right? I mean, it a heck of a lot faster and, you know, potentially even better than I would create on my own, but I did have to kind of go in there and tweak. And so I think there's still a need for that experience and that kind of keen eye on what's being generated. But I do think that we're going to see more and more adoption around AI. I think it's going to become more of a part of the tools that we use in our regular workflows. It's going to become more of a part of the business and the way that we leverage, you know, internal information and data that we have available to us. You know, moving towards like machine learning, I think there's going to be continued to be a lot of work in that area. You know, I mean, we're creating so much data And, you know, we're not even capturing all the data that we create. And so I think we're going to continue to see more there where we're capturing more of that data. We're using more of that data in really new and interesting ways. You know, I work with a couple of healthcare startups and they're doing really, really interesting things with a ton of data and machine learning models. And how can they then deliver, you know, an AI-based solution to their end customer? You know, something that just wasn't even thought of being possible 10 years ago, just given the constraints that we had around, you know, hardware and processing power and all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. I see it inside of what I do as well. It's just amazing how, you know, you get like a request from a client, even for something as simple as like, hey, we need like an email that goes out when this happens, and boom, ChatGPT put in, you learn prompt engineering, and then boom, it's like there, it's done. It's like, it's so, I've said this before on like, I'm not a copy guy. I'm not a person who can like really think through those types of things. So that to me is like a godsend. I'm just like, type this in and spits it out for me and boom, it's done. But that's what's really, really cool about it. And I have, the subtitle here, our friend AI, because it's really interesting to hear you say like, I'm not afraid it's going to take my job. It's not going to say, because you read any kind of thing on newses and they're like, you know, hey, these freelancers, these, you know, design people, they're the first ones to go when it comes to AI. I think you hit the nail on the head with, it's learning to master it and use it and leverage it to move 100 times faster. That's going to set apart the people that are like, this took my job, to no, I'm actually able to produce 1,000x better things for you because of AI. Right.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if it's not AI, it would have been something else that was taking your job because you weren't keeping up. You weren't, you know, continuing to kind of push yourself. And so, yeah, it would be anything else. So you can blame AI if you want, but yeah.
Interesting. All right. I got one more thing I want to talk to you about, and then we'll wrap this up, but SaaS, right? You know, I have my shirt. It's kick SaaS, right? I love it. Ever since I've developed, kind of stumbled into this world of software and learned kind of, you know, the power that SaaS holds, you know, software as a service. Now there's different things I heard of. There's a new term. It's CAS, CASS, code or coding as a service. There's a new one. It's NAS, which is NFT as a service. Like there's all kinds of different crazy things that are now coming with all web 3 things and AI and all this cool stuff. But for the non-technical people out there that we're talking to and that we've kind of had this episode for, you know, there's an awakening that happens, I think, an awakening like of, oh, I see the power. Like for me, at least, that's what that happened was like, oh, I see how software as a service is like the coolest engine, the coolest business model you could ever have. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just when you really get and you have that light bulb moment, it's like, wow, that's really, really awesome. So, you know, what would you say to the people out there who are like, again, you know, we've kind of talked about this already, but like, why would you develop your own SaaS? Why would you go down that road? What, you know, is it just for additional revenue? Is it for outsourcing things? Is it for adding, you know, revenue sources? Again, maybe a little bit more of a generic question, but just interested for your thoughts on this topic as well.
No, I agree. SaaS is incredibly powerful, right? I can, instead of developing my own internal solution or doing it manually very, very slowly, I can pay $10, $12, $100 a month for this platform that enables my business and, you know, people in my business to just do so many more things. And so I think SaaS as a model is really, really powerful in that way. And I think we're seeing even more, instead of like the big SaaS platforms that do so many things and try and be completely embedded in every workflow in an organization, I think we're seeing more like even micro SaaSes that are very focused on specific industries or very focused on very specific problems. And, you know, they don't have the same potential overhead as a bigger SaaS platform. And they're able to operate with 500 paying customers a month, that they're able to charge a higher price per customer each month. And I think that type of model is really, really interesting and really powerful. I mean, that's an area that I'm excited about because I think there's a ton of opportunity. And so I'm working with SaaS companies that are looking at potentially being acquired in 18 months or 2 years. And how can I make the, on like the technology side, how can I make the SaaS software something that somebody wants to acquire? Not only can I say that we have, you know, this many customers, but we have like the strong engineering practices and those sorts of things in place. I think the SaaS model, we're going to continue to see that evolve. I think we'll see a bit of a split. We'll see some companies kind of, you know, be acquired and be brought into bigger kind of suites of tools. And then we'll see also more micro SaaSes that exist out there that just solve a very specific problem for a very specific niche.
Yeah, no, I like that you brought up the micro SaaS because that's super interesting. Some people think of the word SaaS and you think, like you said, it's globally scalable. I'm just going to have the next, you know, ClickFunnels or something like that that's just going to blow up and be crazy successful. But you don't need that. You know what I mean? Like you said, even if you have a couple hundred people paying you per month, like that is a self-sustaining thing that you just, it exists, it's there, and then you slowly improve it. And then, and it's really interesting you talk about things getting acquired. You know, I've always been on, you know, a follower, I don't know if you are, of there's a site out there called Flippa. There's probably other ones too. But you go on there and I get emails every day of like, hey, this SaaS company's for sale and this SaaS company's for sale and whatever. And you go on and you look, and I mean, these people are selling these for like millions and millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like they have, and they're like, hey, their monthly recurring revenue is like $27,000 a month or, you know, something. And it's not like super crazy high. Like some of them obviously will be high. But some of them, like you said, like micro SaaS, but they're valued at like, it's a crazy valuation piece. So that's really cool that you're doing that for people. I like that. Very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, that's about all the time we got, Brian. I really appreciate having you on. We actually went a little bit longer here. That's awesome. So, do you have anything else to add before we wrap this up?
No, I mean, I encourage anyone to reach out if there's anything I might be able to do to help. I've got a huge network. I'm happy to point folks in a good direction. Yeah, I just want to, you know, make sure that we're building great software for our customers and our teams. And so anything I can do.
Sounds good. And we have his site right here. If you can't see it, if you're just listening, it's brianchildress.com, childress.co. Sorry, .co. Those always throw me off, or like the, you know, because you always want to type in .com. We're so used to that. That's interesting. So yeah, it's .co, my friends, .co. All right, Brian, thank you very much. This has been very enlightening, very awesome. Even though, like I said, we're both kind of in that same vein. It's really cool to kind of have these conversations with people. You know, it's an abundant world out there. There's all kinds of opportunities. Mm-hmm. So thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it. This has been a really, really, really enlightening conversation. Really fun to have. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you, Dan. Really enjoyed it.
All right. I'll see you guys on the other side.